That music was The Purple Piece by Anat Cohen from her very beautiful album, Poetica. The show is Sound Health. I'm your host, Sherry Edwards, and thank you for being with us on BBS Radio. And we, each week we attempt to bring you a show or a guest with a theme that's designed to help you live an authentic life, you know, a life full of hope and joy and answers. And we don't often touch on subjects about suffering and loss and pain and grief. But these are very real emotions for us who inhabit this human-dominated planet. So we're going to talk about that tonight with the author, John Welshon. But I have a couple of announcements first. Well, actually three. One, many of you have written to us about our research and you want to know more about what we do here. We're planning a show around that, and we'll catch you up on it. And thank you for your interest in the research going on here at Sound Health. Two, also thank you for your wonderful responses to last week's show with Sylvia Franck and her book, Tree of Life. It was an incredible show. Jump on the archives for BBS Radio. I think it was February 22nd, and you can listen to that show. Okay, three, I've received the complaints, and I admit we haven't had vocal profiling on for a while. We'll get back to evaluating your files online, I promise. Okay, enough announcements. On with the show. Tonight we're going to be talking with John Welshon. He's the author of several books and the creator of Open Heart Seminars. Tonight we're going to talk about his latest book, When Prayers Aren't Answered. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sherry. It's great to be with you.
I am very impressed with your book. When they first talked to me about it, I had a whole different idea.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So let's fill the audience in on the basics of this book, which is sort of about prayer, but it's much more than prayer.
Can yeah,
you give
yeah.
people the basics?
Well, I think that probably if I were to summarize the book, I could do it most easily using a quotation I borrowed from my friend Wayne Dyer, which begins one of the chapters. It says, "The purpose of prayer is not to influence God to grant you special favors, but rather to remind yourself that you are always connected to God." And I've been doing work for many, many years. I'm a meditation teacher in the Buddhist Vipassana tradition. And also have been counseling people who are experiencing terminal illness and people who are grieving and people who have gone through dramatic life-changing episodes, things like spinal cord injury or divorce or on and on and on, all the things that we don't want to have happen to us, that we think we can't possibly have a happy life if we have these kinds of difficulties. And I've seen that the human spirit is incredibly resilient and is much more vast than we ever imagine that it is. And our capacity to cultivate compassion for ourselves and for other human beings through going through some of the experiences of loss and disappointment that we, before they happen and even after they happen, we wish they hadn't happened. But we get to the point where we can either choose to live our lives as a victim, or we can choose to live our lives in a way that uses whatever the circumstance is that the universe has put on our plate in order to grow spiritually. And that's really what the book is about. It's about how to take these difficulties in life and turn them around, turn them into fuel for our spiritual growth. And it really also touches on some of the circumstances in which we have turned our spiritual lives, where we've actually taken cultural values that are American cultural values and tried to turn them into spiritual paths. And that is to say, really, you know, that that I can only be happy if I'm wealthy, or I can only be happy if I, you know, whatever. That we place the conditions of our happiness outside ourselves, so that I need more in the way of possessions and wealth and relationships and prestige and power and fame and things like that, and those things will bring me happiness. And that is a complete illusion, you know? I mean, we need only look at the lives of many of the people who are famous celebrities in our culture to see that fame and money don't bring happiness. And, I mean, I've known a tremendous number of extremely wealthy people in my life, and the truth of the matter is I've only known a few of them who were really happy. So the book really looks at that and says, well, what are the conditions of happiness that really maybe don't have anything to do with getting the things that our culture says we need to be happy?
One of the sentences you said in the preface, understanding of God does not match up with circumstances in which we find ourselves. And what I got out of your book was life's not always fair as we humans see fair, and
right.
We just shouldn't expect it to be.
You know, and I actually got that from Wayne Dyer. You know, when I read his first book, Your Erroneous Zones, back in the 70s. And he had a statement in it. It just said, you know, life isn't fair. Get over it. It was as simple as that, you know. And I think that there is a fairness or there's a lawfulness to life, but I don't know that it's something that we can understand with our human minds or that it is the fairness that we expect. You know, part of our problem is that we tend to look at God in what we sometimes call an anthropomorphic way, which means that we see God as a very large, complex human being, because we just don't know how else to conceptualize it. But so we expect that God thinks the way we think and acts the way we act and has the same kinds of emotions and the same sense of justice. And I don't think that our Creator is anything like that at all. I don't think that that the impulse that created this universe has any relationship really to the kinds of things that we call justice and fairness and so on. But I think that what that Creator is love. Pure, absolute, infinite love. And that's always available to us.
I had a son-in-law who recently got fired in what seemed like an incredibly unfair situation.
Mm-hmm.
And now, a few months later, he has the job of a lifetime. He'll own part of the company. And he said, I am so happy I was fired. I was so devastated at the time, but I am so happy
that
life allowed that to happen.
Isn't that interesting? Well, I mean, and that's the kind of thing that we hear so often, that, you know, it's like a friend of mine... I remember talking to years ago, and he was saying that that he had used all kinds of positive creative visualization and positive affirmation and things like that, and he'd become quite wealthy doing it. And then he started to think, well, maybe, you know, I'm spending so much time controlling the universe to be the way I want it to be. Maybe there's a way that would be more spiritually growthful. And so, you know, sometimes that means that we wind up with something better than we had hoped for. And sometimes it means that we might go through a period of difficulty that later we can emerge from feeling more expanded and a deepened sense of love and peace and joy.
We're going to be taking calls tonight.
Great.
So the toll-free number in the U.S. is 877-876-5227, and in Canada, 888-815-9756, the direct line, 530-876-3222, and for those of you who didn't have a pencil and couldn't run fast enough to write those down, just go to BBS, Boy Sam Radio, bbsradio.com, open station number one, the numbers are right there. We're also going to be taking email at radio@vocalprofiling.com. Now, don't use our other one, soundhealth@soundhealth.org. Most of you write in about that one. A lot of our people don't want to call in. They write to us because they're using their telephone lines to listen to the show. But don't use soundhealth@soundhealth. That email address has been hijacked. So if you haven't heard back from us and you've written to us, that's probably the reason why. So now the emails will start flooding in here. What caused you to want to write this book? I mean, what's behind it? I read in the book, but I want you to tell the audience.
Okay. Well, part of it was this: the first book that I wrote was called Awakening from Grief, and I had so many people read that book and tell me how much they appreciated it and how much it helped them that they kept saying, write another book. So partially it was coming from that. But then, you know, I was looking at the fact that that I have dealt with so many people, wonderful, kind-hearted, loving, decent human beings who have prayed for something and their prayers weren't answered the way they wanted them to be. I was invited to give a talk at a church in San Diego a number of years ago. And when they invited me, I said to the minister, well, what would you like me to talk about? And she said, well, you're here in the month. It's our month to focus on the power of prayer. So maybe something about an aspect of prayer. And I said, well, in my work, I'm always working with people whose prayers weren't answered or weren't answered the way they wanted them to be. And how about a presentation about that? And she said, oh, that'd be lovely. And when I got to the church, the response of the congregation was so strong that I started to realize this is something that's seldom talked about. You know, as you mentioned in the intro to your show this evening, we don't generally like to talk, but we want to talk about positive things. We don't want to talk about the difficult things in life. But I saw also that a number of people would say, you know, when I went through difficulties in my life, if they were affiliated with a church or a spiritual community that was all about creating positive things in life, and then suddenly some member of their family had a tragic death or something terrible happened to them, they felt sort of isolated from their spiritual community and felt like they were almost being shamed because they weren't, you know, that their prayers and affirmations and meditations weren't resulting in the positive result, and they didn't know where to turn with that.
There's a quote in your book, I don't remember where I read it, I just remember reading it, that if you think your prayers aren't being answered, you're probably not listening close enough.
Right. That was a quotation from a friend of mine. And I was just talking about writing the book, and that was her response. And, you know, I just included many different responses from different perspectives and different spiritual teachers and different spiritual traditions, because I really could see that there were so many different perspectives on it, from those who say, well, prayer is always answered. It's just that either we can't hear the answer, or we don't like the answer, or the answer is wait, you know. Running the gamut to people who say, well, you know, prayer is a meaningless exercise because there is no God, or if there is, you know, the Creator doesn't listen to prayer. So, you know, I think that, you know, I've seen in my own life, like when I was 3 years old, and I tell this story and when prayers aren't answered, that I had a miraculous healing from polio, which was directly attributable to the power of prayer. It was my father gathering together all of his friends and family and business associates and saying, you know, our son is very sick with polio. Would you pray for him in whatever tradition you practice? This was the early 1950s, and in that time, the spiritual landscape in America was pretty much, you know, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. And so he had people in all those traditions praying, and a few days later, he had a vision of Jesus standing next to my hospital bed with his hand on my forehead. And my father woke up from the vision. He said, you know, that's got to be a good sign. And he ran in and he woke my mother up in the middle of the night and said, don't worry, John, it's going to be all right. And then 20 minutes later, there was a phone call at 2:30 in the morning from the hospital. And they said, there has been a miracle. Your son's fever has broken. He's up and alert, and there doesn't seem to be any sign of significant paralysis. And he's demanding pancakes, which just goes to show that even coming close to dying doesn't get rid of desire.
Well, you talk in your book, too, about some of Larry Dossey's work showing that scientifically prayer works, even if the people don't believe.
Yeah, but not always. That's the, I mean, it doesn't always work to get you what you want. Now, there are spiritual teachings around that are very popular right now that say, you know, it's just, well, then you're not praying properly. Your thoughts are, you know, there must be some negativity in you somewhere. But, you know, I have found, Sherry, over the years that I've done this work, that I can't imagine, for instance, saying to this mother who's been coming to me recently because her 22-year-old son was killed in a car accident, that his death was somehow the result of her negative thoughts. You know, I mean, it's just, it borders on cruelty. And I don't know that I believe that anyway, you know. I mean, I think that certainly, like, my parents were married by Norman Vincent Peale, you know, who wrote the original The Power of Positive Thinking back in the 40s. And that perspective was always very much a part of my family life. And yet, with all the positive thinking in the world, my father didn't heal his own alcoholism. And my mother was alcoholic. And that created a tremendously difficult situation in our home and in my childhood. So, and I used to pray, here I was, this miraculous healing from polio, and yet later when my parents' drinking became very extreme, I was on my knees every night praying that they would stop drinking, and they didn't. So, you know, I've seen both sides of the coin. Now, when I look back years later, and I think of the suffering that I went through as a teenager because of my parents' drinking, you know, the funny thing about it is that I wouldn't trade it for anything. But when I was going through it, I couldn't imagine anything worse. And I couldn't imagine that God was a loving God. And I couldn't imagine that the universe was under any sort of, you know, control. So sometimes it takes a long time, but we have to be open to hear, to see, to experience, to feel, not necessarily a logical conclusion to what we prayed for, but how did the experience that we had shape us? How did it change us? And again, it always goes back to the fundamental choice of, am I going to be a victim all my life and feel that something has happened to me that's going to, you know, I'm ruined forever? Or can I say, whatever this is, I can take this experience and use it to grow.
Well, your book has turned a lot of lives around. It's very heartfelt, very easy to read. You can tell you've drawn a lot from your own experience with it. Would you consider this book a counseling book?
Well, it's interesting. I've had so many people say to me that when they read it, they feel like we're just sitting having a conversation. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I would say, you know, I mean, because to me the best counseling is heart-to-heart communication. And I was so happy when I heard people say that, because I felt, well, that was really the atmosphere that I wanted to create with the book, that we are good friends sitting, discussing some of the most difficult things in life, the things that we don't ever talk about, and finding how we can turn them into positives rather than negatives.
I'm trying to read email that's coming in as you're talking, and there's one here that, you know, I try to shorten them up. This one can't be shortened, and it's talking about a quote from page 9, the last paragraph on page 9 in your book. Do you have your book in front of you?
Let me just grab it. Okay, I've got it.
I think I'd like you to read that. It starts on page 9, goes to page 10.
The one that begins, he said?
When I joined the church.
When I first joined, yeah, this is about a minister I was talking to at a religious science church out west. And it says, one minister spoke with me recently about how happy he is to see his tradition maturing. He said, when I first joined my church, it seemed like most of the members and most of the clergy were primarily concerned with princes, palaces, and parking spaces. They only seemed to be interested in using their faith to procure the people and things they wanted in their lives. It was considered inappropriate to even talk about the difficult moments in life. And if a person wasn't able to use their prayer and visualization to immediately manifest the partner of their dreams, the home of their dreams, the income of their dreams and a parking space every time they needed one, they began to feel shame. They felt unworthy. They felt less spiritual than the people whose lives were going well. And since the church offered them no guidance for dealing with those difficult times in life, they would eventually stop coming to church.
Okay, it looks like he's written two more paragraphs here, down to the one where it ends in the word grief.
He went on to say, this is again the minister, he went on to say, "I am happy to see that changing now. Now we are better able to see the hand of divinity, of the Creator, in every moment of life. Every lecture and workshop I give," this is me talking now, "every lecture and workshop I give in some way reflects on the inevitability of change in our life and in our world. Every one of us will have to deal with changes we don't like. The way we react to unwanted, unexpected loss in our lives and to anything in our universe that we don't like is the foundation of our grief. In essence, it is the resistance to change so firmly entrenched in our minds that creates our grief."
That's beautiful. It's from somebody named Chris. I don't know if this is a male or female. It kind of feels male to me.
Uh-huh.
"Your book changed my life. Actually, two paragraphs in your book on pages 9 and 10 changed my life. Please share them with people. These ideas are so," and lots of O's in there, "important."
And you know, it's interesting. The other day I was doing an interview with a woman in Seattle, and she said to me, "You know," she said, "I've been praying for something for 30 years, and my prayer hasn't been answered." And she said, "When I read your book, I finally realized that I was feeling this tremendous sense of low self-esteem because this prayer wasn't being answered." She said, "I was finally able to let go of that and just say, well, things just are the way they are then." And that was, gave her a tremendous sense of freedom.
Mm-hmm. I think my freedom came when I decided to do everything I could do to help or hinder, and then whatever happens, I accept. And it really helps me. And one of the things in your book that helped me, too, was your explanation of the difference between prayer and meditation.
Uh-huh.
Could you share that?
Sure. The simple way to say it, and it's really oversimplifying, but we could say that prayer is talking to God, and meditation is listening to God. Now, that means that in prayer we're generally we're asking for something to happen, or we're asking for something not to happen that we don't want. And in meditation, we're quieting down and quieting our minds so that we can hear our intuition, so that we're not so distracted by the realm of thought all the time. And now there are many forms of prayer that move from just asking for, a new pair of shoes that we want to what we call contemplative prayer, which is really getting closer to what Wayne Dyer was talking about in that quote that I read, that it's about using prayer to remind ourselves that we're always connected to God. In that sense, contemplative prayer is very similar to meditation. And then there are things that are in the realm of meditation, like things like creative visualization and things like that, which could be a form of meditation, which those look more like prayer. So it's a little confusing. But the easy way to say it is prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening to God.
Well, I also got that from the way, I'm stumbling here. It's not said outright, but this is the concept that I got, that you present prayer as hope, prayer as assurance, prayer as support, prayer almost as hand-holding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way you're meaning the book? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think prayer really runs the gamut of... the question really is, what are we asking for, and it goes all the way from, I remember when I was in high school praying, I was praying that my parents would stop drinking, that was major. I also prayed to have a date with Wendy Miller, which I never had, so that prayer wasn't answered. But then, you know, it gets to, when people ask me now what I pray for, I realize that my prayer life has gotten a lot more like the prayer of St. Francis, which is really that I ask to be an instrument of healing in the world and a vessel of the transmission of love in the world. That's what I ask for. And, you know, then sometimes if I'm not feeling well, or, you know, I've got a little illness or something, or an injury, you know, I'll work on healing that. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that I think I brought up in the book, that I remember when my mother was teaching my sister and I to pray, when we were children, she said, "But you must always end your prayer with 'not my will, but thy will.'" So you ask for whatever you want, but then, you know, when you surrender the determination to have the universe line up the way you want it to. And I think I didn't like that as a child. I thought, you know, I want a way to get what I want. But I think that what she was offering was very wise. So that I think that then when things don't go the way we want them to, when the things happen that we don't want to have happen, or we can't create the result that we are asking for, then we're left with, well, what can I ask for that is available always? Or, you know, what is it that I'm not asking I should be asking? Or what is it in my life that I'm not paying attention to that that is available to me? And that goes back to what I said earlier. Love is always available. Divine love, the love of God, the love of our Creator, the love that is our Creator, that exists inside us, that's always available. It never goes anywhere. And it's just a question of finding it inside ourselves.
Here's an email that goes along with that. In prayer, are we supposed to ask for something? Can you ask to heal your baby brother but not for a sleek new car? Do you think it does any good to bargain with God?
That's a great question. Well, you know, I think we can ask for whatever we want to ask for. But I think that, you know, certainly if the choice, for instance, if you had to make a choice. Now, again, you know, there are a lot of spiritual teachings that want to say ask and you will receive, right? Well, but that's all well and good when it works, but it doesn't always work. And it doesn't always work for reasons far beyond our own personal thought patterns. Now, if you had to make a choice between a sleek new car and your sibling's health or your child's health, I don't think there would be a choice there for most parents. I mean, it wouldn't even be a question. The car is no longer relevant.
I don't think this is an either-or question. It was
right,
just like,
I understand.
You know, what are you really supposed to pray for?
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that that you can pray for anything you want to pray for. I mean, I don't think that my role is to tell people what to pray for or not to pray for. But I think that in the long run, what is really meaningful is what's going to really bring happiness in life. And that's why I spent a lot of time in the book talking about things like a sleek new car. Now, for instance, and the fact that it doesn't really bring happiness. I used to carry around with me a magazine ad that I had cut out of Sports Illustrated, I think, and it was a full-page, full-color ad for Rolls-Royce motor cars. And it was a fascinating ad. It was so poignant because it was a photograph of two cars stopped at a traffic light in what was obviously Beverly Hills. I mean, it might have been Palm Beach in Florida, but I think it was Beverly Hills in California. Tall, elegant palm trees, big, beautiful mansions on either side of the road. And the traffic light, there are two cars stopped. The car in the right lane is a brand new $90,000 BMW. And the car in the left lane is a brand new $300,000 Rolls Royce. And the man behind the wheel of the brand new $90,000 BMW is looking longingly at the $300,000 Rolls Royce. And the caption of the ad was, Rolls-Royce is simply the finest motor car in the world. But I pasted a thing over that and wrote in, it's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, if you are pursuing happiness outside yourself, it will never be enough. You know, I can use the example of people who say, well, I'll be happy when I have $1 million. I can't tell you how many people I've known who got $1 million and still weren't happy. But then they say, well, I must need $10 million. So then they'll go make $10 million, and they have $10 million. They say, I'm still not happy. I must need $100 million. It's never ending.
Well,
and yet, you know, there's a small group of really wealthy people that I've known in my life who are very happy. And I'm always so fascinated by that. I have to ask them, what is it in your life that makes you happy? You know, they always say the same thing. And they never say, it's my fancy cars, it's my beautiful houses, it's my furs, my jewelry, my yacht, my airplane. They never say that. You know what they say? They say it's helping other people, giving my money away and helping other people. That's what makes me happy. That's where the real juice is in my life. And so this is a long-winded answer to the question, but I think having heard all that, if you still want a fancy new car, then pray for a fancy new car, you know?
Well, that's my idea of being rich, have enough money to give away anything I wanted.
Yeah, but it's a very complicated process to get there sometimes.
With this email, I think the idea there is there's some limit. You can only pray up to this limit or for these things, or you feel guilty if you're going to ask for a sleek new car. You're going to feel guilty if you ask, if you make my mom well and I'll do this. You know, looks like there's some limit this guy is setting on.
Well, I don't think there's any limit to what you can ask. I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, I think if you ask for something and you don't feel good about asking, it's interesting to look at that, you know. I just don't know that, you know, one of the things that I think is confusing for people, because of the culture we live in, I don't think this is a spiritual truth. I think it's a cultural delusion that happiness comes from wealth and material possessions. So then, I mean, there are often, and this dates back hundreds of years to, like, John Calvin was one of the first that I've discovered, who determined, you know, when we look at how do I know if God loves me? Well, John Calvin, who was a theologian back in the 1500s or 1600s, said, well, we'll know that God loves us if we're rich. But obviously, he'll make us rich if he loves us, and he'll make us poor if he doesn't love us. I think that's just goofy. That doesn't make any sense at all to me. Because I would think, you know, I look at, you know, funny, I was just last night, I was watching this wonderful movie called 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama, which I highly recommend. And it's out on DVD. And this fellow is traveling through India, and he's arranged an interview with the Dalai Lama, and he's thinking, well, what 10 questions do I want to ask him? And as he's doing this, he's going through, even in India, he's looking and he's seeing the people living in the most extreme conditions of poverty look and appear to be and genuinely are much happier than most of the people in our culture who are much wealthier. And I'm not even talking about, you know, multimillionaires in this culture. I'm talking about, you know, average people in the middle class here whose life circumstances are so much better materially than 95% of the people in India, and yet the poor people in India look happy. This is something that has always fascinated Americans who go to India. And then the wealthy people in India don't look so happy. What is that? That's fascinating, you know? So I don't think that the issue is really a moral issue. It isn't immoral to pray for wealth or for material success. It's just if you're pursuing happiness that way, I don't think you're going to find it necessarily. That wealth in and of itself doesn't bring happiness. That's absolutely true.
Well, ask somebody, would they rather have unlimited wealth or unlimited health?
Yeah, well, there's a good question.
See where they go.
Yeah.
Here's another question. I would love to have faith, but the church I was raised in is filled with leaders who let me down. In other words, they are hypocrites. How do I get beyond that to faith?
Well, I think that that's really an issue of pursuing your spiritual path within your own heart. You know, there is no spiritual tradition that has an absence of hypocritical leaders and leaders who fall on their faces and leaders who make mistakes. And, you know, if you really, if you want, a friend of mine used to say, if you are looking for spiritual teachers, you're just going to become a connoisseur of clay feet. But if you're looking for spiritual teaching, you know, that's a different thing. And the teaching is about even using, you know, hypocritical spiritual leaders and looking at that and saying, well, it's not in them, it's in me, you know? So that I have to find what it is I'm looking for in my own heart. It's like some of the things that I love about Buddha's teaching. You know, for instance, Buddha never asked people to have faith. You know, he said, don't believe anything you haven't experienced for yourself. So really his path was about, here's, you know, if you want what I experience, this is the way to do it. Here's the path. This is the formula. Here's the recipe. You know, if you follow this, you can have the same experience I have. You know, never mind me. Find it in yourself. I remember Jack Kornfield, who's a wonderful teacher in the same meditation tradition I practice. What his first book, Living Buddhist Masters, he talked about different Buddhist teachers that he had been with in Asia. And one of them he challenged because he felt that the teacher was being hypocritical. Exactly the question that your listener raised. And the teacher looked at him and he said, well, you know, he said, the truth is that you ought to be happy about the shortcomings in your teachers because they remind you that the Buddha is nowhere to be found but within yourself. And you could say the same thing about Christ or Krishna or God or, you know, the divine, that it's no place to be found but in yourself. So, and when you find it there, what other people say and do doesn't really matter so much anymore. Now, you know, I would, yeah, that all being said, you know, we all need teachers along the way, and I would encourage you to do your best to find teachers that maybe aren't so prone to being hypocritical and so on. But the ultimate place that you find the teaching is inside yourself.
And it's obvious from your book that you studied many religions.
Yeah,
and
it's
not just from one perspective of one church.
Right. Well, my academic background was in comparative religions, world religions. So I really studied all traditions. Yeah, and I've practiced a number of different traditions. So my perception of it is it all leads to the same place. If you practice it purely, it all leads to the same place. You know, another interesting thing about Buddha was that Buddhism is sometimes misidentified as an atheistic religion. And that's not really the case. I mean, really what Buddha said was that if there is a God, it must be something that is so vast and so incomprehensible that there's no way we could understand it with our human minds. So why confuse ourselves by trying? And look what happens when we do try. You know, pretty soon everybody's arguing over whose idea of God is the right idea, and eventually they even start killing each other over whose idea of God is the right one.
There's a couple questions about that come in, too.
Uh-huh.
I read a quote once that if you put all the great leaders of all the great religions in one room, they would agree, but one each of their followers would create dissension.
Yeah, yeah.
The lady's question that you just answered, she just wrote back, I loved that answer. I totally agree. So some feedback about your good advice.
Uh-huh.
This is a painful question from one of our listeners. I felt incredible grief when I found out my husband of 10 years was having an affair. The emotional pain was indescribable. I wished to be dead so the pain would go away. Is there an easier way through something like this? Do you think God is punishing me for something?
You know, I do not believe that God punishes. That's one of the main things in the book, that I believe God is love, or the expression of God in the world of form, in the physical universe, is love. And the higher and purer our love, the closer we are to God. So I don't think that God punishes. I think, you know, I was thinking about this question today, and I was thinking about, you know, when you're a parent, you know, there's always that image of teaching your child not to put their hand on a hot fire because they'll get burned. You know, fire is an extraordinary thing that was given to us by the physical universe. It is an incredible tool. We can use it for heat. We can use it to cook our food. We can use it to purify certain things. But it also can be used for destruction, for self-destruction and for the destruction of other things and other people. Now, you know, when you're a child and you put your hand in a fire, you get burned. Is that punishment? I don't think so. I mean, it's just like, and so, you know, if you're a quick learner, you learn, well, I'm not going to do that again. If you continue to put your hand in the fire and you continue getting burned, is that punishment? I don't think so. I think it's just sort of a misuse of one of the principal resources in the physical universe. Now, to get back to this very heartbreaking question about the sense of being betrayed by someone that we have loved and trusted and who has been a life partner, you know, it's hard to imagine a pain greater than that. And when you're going through it, it's so unimaginable that you think, you know, as your listener said, there are moments when you might think, I'd rather not exist than have to feel this pain. I think in some sense it also, it has some connection to the earlier question where we're talking about spiritual teachers who disappoint us. You know, most human beings are going to disappoint us. One of my teachers in India used to say, your only friend is God. Your only friend is God. And when I got that, you know, I remember a period in my own life where there was a small group of people in my life who I thought, well, if everything else falls down around me, these people will never disappoint me. And then every one of them did. And I was just devastated. And I felt so alone. And then I realized that I was alone face-to-face with God, or face-to-face with the Creator, or face-to-face with my own heart. And that was the moment when I realized that the only security, the only safety, is in my connection with my Creator. However I perceive that, but I perceive it to be inside me, that anything in the physical universe is subject to change, that everybody I know and love is capable of, at any moment in time, doing something shocking and disappointing. And if my happiness is contingent on their behavior, I got a problem. You know, and that's how we make ourselves really vulnerable. I do workshops for couples and for people just exploring the dynamics of relationships. And one of the things that I share with people, because I also, as you know, do work with grief, and I'll say that if there is one unerring way to condemn ourselves to a life of almost perpetual grief, and that is to tie our happiness to someone else's behavior. You know, I mean, it's that thought in our minds that say, it says, I'll be happy when he does so-and-so, or she does so-and-so, or when he stops doing so-and-so, or when she's, you know, forget it. You know, I hate to say it, but... Pardon me?
Talk about your open heart workshops and what people can expect and how they can get in touch with you about them.
Well, the website is openheartseminars.com, and you can email me. The email address is John, J-O-H-N, at openheartseminars.com. Right now, the schedule isn't on the website, but we do. If you sign up to be on our email list, and we don't sell it to anyone or loan it out, you'll just hear from me if you sign up to be on it. And we send out periodic newsletters and schedules. And there's a variety of workshops that I do. Most of them nowadays are focused on meditation or some aspect of spiritual life. I also do workshops called the Soul of Relationship or the Yoga of Relationship, in which we look at our relationships in a whole new way so that we're not so caught in that approach to relationship in which we say, you know, the role of this other human being is to make me happy. That's a problem. So we look at relationships differently. But we look at them as a very, very beautiful arena in which to do spiritual work. I also do workshops called Awakening from Grief, Finding the Way Back to Joy, and those are about dealing with the difficult experiences in life and how to progress through that feeling of despair that the last email that you read expressed, you know, that feeling of just overwhelming pain, and how to find the glimpses of joy and happiness and find a way back into trusting the universe and in a way that you can really open your heart and feel love again. Because ultimately, the thing that we fear the most when we grieve is that we've lost the ability to feel love. And we never lose that. We just have to find a new way to access it in our own hearts. So, and then I also do workshops for professional and volunteer caregivers, people who do, you know, like nurses, social workers, hospice workers, addictions counselors, clergy, and then people who are caring for family members. And those workshops have various names, sometimes Caring for the Caregiver. There's also one called The Smile of Unbearable Compassion. And those are about how to do that work without burning out, without getting lost in frustration and anger, but, you know, really learning how to use very difficult work as a means of going deeper spiritually and enhancing your joy in life rather than losing your joy.
Are these group sessions or just lectures? Are they work groups?
Well, generally my workshops are a combination of lecture and question and answer and a variety of different exercises that we do, some meditation exercises, some group work. It's depends on the workshop and the group and what it is we're doing and how much time we have and so on. But some of them are, you know, I do anything from a one-hour lecture to five-day retreats. So the retreats are wonderful because they obviously give us a lot more time to get more deeply into the issues.
I don't know if you want to touch on this. I don't know if it's in your book or not. I didn't see it. But the question is, I recently lost my mother. The pain of her passing was deep, but even more pain came when we realized she did not have a will. This is traumatic, and no amount of praying helped, nor did the law or legal system provide any solace. Can you provide any advice to people in general to prevent this from happening? Be prepared emotionally, but I believe the aftermath with all these legal hassles was just as traumatic for my family.
You know, it's a very interesting one. I mean, certainly, just as a practical matter, I would recommend that people write a will. And it also has an interesting spiritual component to it because it's really about acknowledging your own mortality and taking a responsible approach so that you're not going to leave a mess behind for your family and loved ones. Now, I'll share something that, and I don't mean this to be all about me, but in my own family, my father left a will, and sometimes people leave a will that you're not too happy with. So I had a lot of issues with my father after I read his will. But then I just looked at it, and I had to say, well, you know, the the problem with our human minds is that we're always looking at the conditions of our lives and saying, this shouldn't have happened. This should be different than it is. This person should be different than they are. They shouldn't act this way. This shouldn't be happening. This is wrong. This is a mistake. That is another surefire prescription for suffering. You know, and at some point, when we really start to turn the corner to find a way to be happy in life, it's when we really let go of those ideas about should and shouldn't and just allow ourselves to be with what is. Now, that doesn't mean complacency. That doesn't mean, I mean, here in this situation, just because you are facing a circumstance of the incredible legal tangles of trying to deal with someone who dies without a will, and the state ultimately winding up deciding where the assets go in that case, you know, it's just not prudent. It's not a kind thing to do to your to the people who are going to be left to clean up the mess, but it also is not very healthy to spend your life angry at that person because they didn't make a will. So this is the moment at which we just kind of surrender to what is. Okay, they didn't leave a will. I'm going to have to sort this out. This is a new circumstance, a new situation, one that I didn't want, but here we are.
Well, we're almost out of time. I'd like to read to you some of the questions we didn't get to because they're great questions. Is God a person or a concept? It must be somebody who read your book. Can you explain why you feel comfortable talking about God because you make the statement that you have no idea what that means? Is it okay to challenge God when we ask for proof, or is this against some unwritten law? Is heaven a geographic location? I have a problem with using the ideas of God's law to kill and keep people in bondage. Is there a set of God's laws? And do you believe in reincarnation? Mm. I guess we're going to have to have you back.
Because I'll come back. That'll be delightful.
Good questions.
They're great questions.
The title of your latest book, When Prayers Aren't Answered, you can find it on Amazon or your favorite store. Amazon gives your book 5 stars.
Oh, I love that.
it says somewhere in your book, I just thought it was a great thing, maybe it's on the cover, John Wilshans does not ignore suffering, nor does he attempt to put a smiling face on tragic events. While looking directly at life's most challenging experiences, John helps us learn how to work through those trials to become fully alive and awake with honesty, love, and equanimity. Great interview. I love your heartfelt answers. We'll make arrangements to have you back.
I'd love that, Shari, and thank you. I love your heartfelt questions and the wonder. You must have just incredible people in your listening audience because those are wonderful questions.
They are good people, and we love doing this show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.